everyone, and welcome to today's program entitled Help for the Helper, the Effects of Trauma and Compassion Fatigue on the Lawyer Who Cares. My name's Brian Quinn. I'm an attorney, and I'm the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, which is Pennsylvania's Lawyers Assistance Program. I hope you'll find today's program interesting. It's a little bit different, but I think it's very timely. I've been doing this for LCL of Pennsylvania since 2017. I'm always happy to provide programs of this type to lawyers around the country, and this is no exception. This is one of my favorite topics. I think it's very timely, as I said. It's maybe not something that we talk about too often, but I think you'll find some of the things that I am going to discuss, you might recognize some of them. And hopefully it'll help you if you're feeling any of these feelings in connection with your own practice. I'll give you some tips. I have an agenda. I talk about the Lawyers Assistance Program services. We're going to talk about burnout and secondary trauma, then compassion fatigue, which is the main topic of today's presentation, and then why lawyers are at risk to suffer from these mental health issues. And then hopefully we'll be able to wrap it all up with some strategies that actually are realistic and that work. So that's the agenda. So let's start off with the first topic, which is Lawyers Assistance Program Services. As I said, I've been doing this for LCL of Pennsylvania since 2017. There's a Lawyer Assistance Program in all 50 states. They're a little bit different. I can't say that I'm familiar with each and every one of them, but I can assure you that the programs that I am familiar with, and that's the vast majority of the country, follow some basic guidelines by providing a caring peer assistance programs. And our purpose really and our mission is to save the lives and restore the health and professional competence of lawyers, members of their families, in some case, depending on the state, judges and law students. I say that because, for example, we in Pennsylvania provide non-clinical services to Pennsylvania lawyers, judges, and their family members. I always hope that people will consult with the Lawyers Assistance Program services available in their jurisdiction, wherever you practice, wherever you're licensed, because some provide household members with services. We provide any family member, no matter how distant, and some limit it to just the lawyer. So be aware of that. And not only check your laws of your Lawyers Assistance Program services, but also the rules of professional conduct, because we see a strong connection between some of these issues, the substance use disorders, mental health issues, and disciplinary matters. We pride ourselves here in Pennsylvania, and I think I can speak for the majority of Lawyers Assistance Program, the vast majority, that people often confuse us as being part of the disciplinary process in a given state, and that's really not the case. We try to maintain, and in our case in Pennsylvania, we do maintain a totally independent position, because really the number one concern among members of our profession, and the reason that they seem to give us when we poll other programs throughout the country, is when we ask why don't the lawyers in your state contact you and take advantage of your program, the answer is usually the same: fear of disclosure, fear that it won't be held confidential. So confidentiality is a really big part of a lawyer's assistance program. We operate around the clock. Most programs have a confidential helpline, and that's operated, as I said, for the most part, in most states, around the clock, 365 a year, without any exception. You can remain anonymous and receive services from a lawyer's assistance program. I know that many programs provide evaluations by a healthcare professional. Some of them have clinicians on their staff. Once again, that's something you need to check with. So if someone can't afford a healthcare professional, will be asked to give an evaluation free of charge. check your state once again. As lawyers, we know to do that. Check the local rules, so to speak. In this case, it would be the statewide program and the rules of professional conduct that govern the practice of law in your licensing state. Once again, the most important thing about all of our programs is that they're confidential, non-judgmental, and non-obligatory. You can remain anonymous and still receive them. Nobody reports things without someone's permission or consent. No identifying information is shared, so that we try to remove that fear that's associated with asking for help from a program. The most important thing before I move on to the rest of the agenda is be familiar with the rules of professional conduct as they relate to the disclosure of information provided or gained by a lawyer or a judge while participating in your state's approved lawyer's assistance program. Some states follow the ABA model rule, rules of professional conduct, and that the rule that applies specifically to this topic is rule 8.3. There's a different subsection in some states, in Pennsylvania, for example, it's 8.3C, that does not require, it provides an exception to the duty to report known misconduct. In other words, any information given and gained by a lawyer or a judge while participating in an approved lawyer's assistance program is subject to the exception to the duty to report. It really goes beyond confidentiality. It's specifically an exception to the duty to report, the highest level of really safety that we can think of. Why'd the court do that? Well, because they understand, and lawyers and judges may hesitate to seek assistance from our programs for the reasons I've already stated: fear of disclosure, fear that it will be held confidential. What will people say if they find out that I asked for help? My goodness. So providing for an exception encourages lawyers and judges to seek treatment through our programs, because without that exception, there will be that hesitancy, that reluctance, which will then result in most cases in additional harm to their professional careers, additional injury to the welfare of clients and to the public. And that's what we don't want to happen, nor do the courts. So that's why many states follow that ABA model rule 8.3. So let's get on with the next topic. I have it entitled Burnout and Secondary Trauma. We're kind of leading up to the ultimate topic of compassion fatigue. But in the meantime, I want to ask you a question. Why did you become a lawyer? As you reflect on that question, more than one answer may come up for you. Maybe you have wanted to be a lawyer since you were a child. We know many lawyers, including myself, I can say that, and I'm an example of this, for whom that's true. Maybe a family member was a lawyer. They influenced you. Maybe you were intrigued and fascinated by the law, or you saw the legal profession as a solid career that could open other doors for you. Whatever your reason or reasons, we're pretty sure that many of us were attracted to the legal profession because we care about people and want to help. There are plenty of negative lawyer jokes out there, but the truth is, lawyers care. And sometimes lawyers care too much. So let's get started with our next topic. And we'll talk about what burnout is. We hear a lot about burnout. It's important to note right up front that compassion fatigue is different than burnout. So I want to start by looking briefly at burnout, but what burnout really means. Many people feel that a lawyer's work could become tedious and boring. You sit in a chair all day looking at documents all day, reviewing documents, editing documents, arguing over documents. You sit in silence all day. You work alone a lot of the time. You're required to concentrate most of the day. You need to pay attention to every detail, read every word. You have to deal with procedures and rules and regulations. And yeah, you deal with other people's problems all day. You manage a lot of fighting. You work with and against people who are trying to bring you and your client down. If you're a litigator, maybe a criminal or matrimonial law attorney, you sit in court all day waiting for your case to be called, regardless of whether you practice transactional or litigation-based law. Really and truly, many lawyers, if not all, are really paper pushers a lot of the time. You get the idea. clients don't give you or all of your cases are not thrilling missions to complete. Sure, you may have been involved with some compelling case or brief moment in your career where you were the hero for your client. Sure, some of you might recall the case you argued in front of the Supreme Court or the significant settlement or verdict or outcome you landed. Yeah, they were likely exciting, but they were the exception to the rule in most cases. We live in a culture of disconnection, distraction, and overload that's a perfect breeding ground for burnout. And the law, with its unforgiving culture, long hours, billable time system of compensation and productivity, presents especially acute risks for burnout. So what exactly is burnout? What does it mean? So let's look at it. The term burnout is used casually and frequently, but a formal definition is surprisingly elusive. Burnout is not, repeat, not an official medical diagnosis. Some people define burnout as a disease of disengagement, but you're not going to find anything in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, that the medical professionals use to treat and diagnose people suffering with substance use disorders or mental health issues. You're not going to find burnout in there. It's a chronic process of unplugging and disconnecting from work, friends, family, and health. The most important part of that definition is the word chronic. Burnout arises slowly. To a large extent, burnout is the result of a mismatch between demands and resources. And I'm not referring to economic resources. It develops when someone is dealing with a high level of stress, but doesn't have access to adequate resources such as social support, helpful advice, feedback from friends or colleagues, or control over how they spend their time. But occupationally, burnout has been described as a special type of work-related stress, a state of physical or emotional exhaustion that also involves a sense of reduced accomplishment and loss of personal identity. So lawyers are at extremely high risk for burnout, due in large part because the job description of being an attorney demands more from the lawyer than they can reasonably provide. This gap, if you will, creates the unique attorney burnout and lawyer anxiety you, unfortunately, may know so well. There are three core symptoms of burnout that include fatigue. No matter how much someone rests or sleeps, it's an exhaustion that runs deeper than sleep deprivation. Can't be cured by a few days off. Cynicism about life, or feeling that nothing a person does really matters. The burned out lawyer is not excited about their work, even major successes and things that they once loved, and they feel generally disengaged. And last is a sense of inefficacy. Burned out lawyers feel like they're exerting significant effort, but are not making any progress or gaining any recognition. So, as I said, there's no medical diagnosis for burnout. It's not in that DSM. Thus, many people and their physicians have a hard time recognizing burnout because its symptoms are not unique to the condition of burnout. So you see some of the, manifestations of it: constant anxiety, changes in personality, irritability, pessimism, obsessive thoughts, feeling overwhelmed. But unfortunately, our personalities as lawyers and our profession already put us at high risk for burnout. Because in addition to the challenges of practicing law, some people contend that lawyers tend to have personality traits that make them more prone to burnout. Once again, perhaps the most significant such trait is perfectionism. Lawyers' inherent personality traits, along with the adversarial high-pressure nature of the work, creates a perfect incubator for burnout. Lawyers tend to be perfectionists, setting impossible to meet standards for themselves, and that's really the sense that nothing is ever good enough. I don't know if any of you feel that way about some of your work or all of your work. Sometimes we can be adaptive perfectionists. Sometimes, though, it can slip into a maladaptive form of perfectionism. Why? Well, lawyers are trained to be on the constant lookout for problems, be responsible for taking care of clients. In other words, we're problem solvers, aren't we? And I always caution people, have you become nothing other than a problem collector? Are you still a problem solver or just collecting everybody else's problems for a living? So this inherent pessimism over what might go wrong creates a sense that problems are everywhere. And the true urgency of those problems becomes exaggerated at times. And lawyers, unfortunately, often fail to seek out help when needed, not wanting to appear weak. They face constant deadlines set by the courts, other parties, clients, over which they have very little control. Lawyers like to be in control. And if you haven't heard this before, here's an alert. Lawyers are control freaks in many cases. I say that with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek. Law firms, in turn, rarely foster an atmosphere where a lawyer experiencing burnout would feel comfortable exposing and getting help for it because it could be perceived as a weakness. Hey, law firms are competitive places. There are always increasing demands for greater productivity at lower cost and with limited, highly competitive opportunities for advancement. So new technologies also add pressure on lawyers who feel constantly tethered to their work and client demands. So we know that the law demands acute attention to detail. I'm not trying to suggest that that's the adaptive perfectionism, I suppose, where you care about the quality of your work. I understand that. But sometimes we feel that the price for making a mistake is beyond our control and we start to get overwhelmed. And after all, we know that mistakes can cost millions of dollars for the transactional lawyer, the family lawyer, loss of custody of a child, the criminal lawyer, a life in prison. And lawyers are thus served well, at least professionally, by their perfectionism. But that same perfectionism can make them feel like their work is never good enough. And that's the sort of perfectionism that's a major risk factor for burnout. So we know we're not alone to some extent. There are other careers that have high stress. So why are lawyers at a higher risk of burnout than many other working professionals? Why do lawyer stress statistics show that lawyers are experiencing greater stress levels than their counterparts in other professions? Usually there's a combination of factors at work. And they work together over time to create overworked, stressed out, burned out lawyers. So aside from our personality type, perfectionism, and excessive hours, we need to look at our professional culture. But you might be saying, wait, I know it's a tough profession, but it's worth it. And besides that, I have a lot of clients that are really counting on me to help them. So I'll just have to deal with the other stuff. That leads me into the main topic for today, how the helper, the problem solver, turns into a problem collector and oftentimes puts themselves last. And that's when we need help for the helper. So now we're getting into the next phase of the cycle that ends with compassion fatigue. As I said, it's important to note that compassion fatigue is different than burnout. So while burnout is predictable, building over time and resulting in work dissatisfaction, compassion fatigue has a narrower focus. There are three dimensions of compassion fatigue, and we just discussed the first dimension, which is burnout. The next dimension, if you will, secondary traumatic stress, also known as vicarious trauma or secondhand shock. So what is it? As I said, it's the second element and second component of compassion fatigue, and it has everything to do with continued exposure to accounts of extremely or traumatically stressful events from those who experienced them firsthand. So secondary traumatic stress is acquired vicariously from working with a trauma survivor. So what do we mean by trauma? The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, has stated that trauma results from an event, series of events, or set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or threatening, and that has lasting adverse effect on the individual's functioning physically, socially, emotionally, or spiritually. As for what that all means for the lawyer, or in many cases the judge, we need to look at it a little bit more closely. You know, but it has to be addressed and processed emotionally, physically, cognitively, and spiritually to prevent and or treat negative long-term impact on a survivor. Okay, we're getting close. We're moving onto secondary traumatic stress in lawyers and judges. And as I said, it could be the cumulative effect of listening to clients' stories. And it doesn't matter. It's not just this gruesome testimony, photos dealing with traumatized people. But, you know, it could be, as I said, for the matrimonial lawyer, you know, a constant diet of listening to people's marital custody, protection from abuse, all sorts of issues that go on. Children and youth service lawyers seem to be affected by it. Personal injury lawyers who are dealing with traumatically, physically and psychologically injured clients. There's so many different types of law practice that gets into these types of trauma. Sometimes we don't realize just how many there are. Even the estate attorneys tell me, you know, I'm dealing with people who have suffered the loss of a loved one, and then sometimes there's fighting among family members over the administration of an estate. So it can be a lot of different areas of the law, but we do find that especially in family and criminal law, criminal defense especially, and judges, by the way, in those courts, seem to have a lot higher percentage of secondary traumatic stress. What happens? You start to avoid certain questions in client interviews. You don't have the same empathy toward your clients. You over-identify sometimes with your client. We find that emotionally it starts to make us argumentative or impatient. We can even have intrusive dreams, disturbing images from cases intruding into our thoughts and our dreams. So moving on to the next topic then, here we are, compassion satisfaction and compassion fatigue. Yep, let's talk about not compassion fatigue first, but there is such a thing as compassion satisfaction. That's defined as the pleasure one derives from being able to do their work well as a helping professional. It encompasses the pleasure and satisfying feeling that comes from helping other people. Remember the first question I asked you, why'd you become a lawyer? Many people enter helping professions like ours because they have empathetic attitudes for others' difficulties and a strong desire to assist in alleviating those difficulties. The problem solver's realm. So here we are. Compassion satisfaction is in direct contrast to burnout or secondary traumatic stress, vicarious trauma, in other words. The lawyer with compassion satisfaction experiences sustained motivation or even inspiration and enjoyment, a sense of achievement from the emotionally demanding involvement in helping trauma survivors heal from their traumas. But for many of us, that fulfillment of the professional goals we set, as I said, often at a very early stage, leaves us and is replaced by something that we didn't plan for when we went to law school. Wait a second. Lawyers care. Remember? That's why we make the sacrifices required to be successful, effective advocates for our clients. We work long hours, deal with adversity, often on a daily basis, and are often criticized for what we do. We are compassionate in that we feel the pain of others and want to use our skills to help. However, we can become overwhelmed by the trauma and stresses of our clients. We care so much that it becomes too much. And that's when we have to think about compassion fatigue. It's the cumulative physical, emotional, and psychological effect of exposure to traumatic stories or events when working in a helping capacity, combined with the strain and stress of everyday life. Deep spiritual, physical, and emotional exhaustion that results from long-term cumulative stress in work situations that are emotionally demanding. attorneys who have experienced compassion fatigue describe it as being almost caught in a kind of a downward spiral that slowly pulls them deeper into their feelings of apathy and despair in some cases. In an attempt to stop that, we'll call it decline, they work harder and continue to give to others, finding it increasingly difficult to maintain empathy, objectivity, and a healthy work-life balance. So working hard becomes a coping strategy that allows them to ignore what they're feeling. This, of course, only perpetuates the decline. So I want to talk about the stages of compassion fatigue now that we've kind of defined it. And these stages, you'll see on the materials, there's four of them. They were put together by a doctor of social work and named Zaporanik and Tracy Zaporanik, who's affiliated with the University of Tennessee. And this is how it's characterized. The first phase, okay, is the zealot phase. Person is passionate and excited about their work. They may go above and beyond to show their commitment and eagerness to excel. Okay, I'll let you think about that one for a second. Then the next phase is the irritability phase. Feelings of enthusiasm start to wane, followed by avoiding work responsibilities. So while still performing in their problem solver role, their commitment to quality work declines and they become more careless and make mistakes. They have really already become problem collectors and they may not even realize it yet. The third phase is the withdrawal phase. No longer feeling passionate about their work, the line between personal life and work responsibilities starts to get a little blurry. The lack of clear boundaries results in irritability towards and about those we represent and totally detachment from the helping role. The next phase is the zombie phase. I don't like the name of that one, but I don't know why. I guess maybe it's all the movies that are out now. But the zombie phase in this case talks about the lawyer who continues to distance themselves from those they take care of and sink into depression. They may feel despondent and angry and project this onto colleagues, viewing them as being incompetent. What are some of the symptoms of compassion fatigue? Well, I think that's probably a good place to move on to. There's a lot of them. When you see the materials, you'll see I have I've enumerated 11 different symptoms. And I'll kind of summarize them for you as best I can, under the time constraints that we have here. But perceiving the resources and support available for work as chronically outweighed by the demands is one symptom. Having client and work demands regularly encroach on personal time. Okay. Feeling over, does that count those Sunday morning phone calls that I accept? Yes. Feeling overwhelmed and physically and emotionally exhausted. Having disturbing images from cases intrude into thoughts and dreams. Becoming pessimistic, cynical, irritable, and prone to anger. Viewing the world as inherently dangerous. Becoming increasingly vigilant about personal and family safety is a symptom of compassion fatigue. Then, becoming emotionally detached and numb in professional and personal life. Experiencing increased problems in personal relationships. A person suffering from compassion fatigue.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is TAG, T-A-G, all lowercase, TAG. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is TAG, TAG, all lowercase. TAG. Please take a moment and write this down.
Starts to withdraw socially. Okay? Becomes emotionally disconnected from other people. They become demoralized. They start to question one's professional competence and effectiveness. Secretive. Self-medication can start. And yes, that can indeed lead to misuse, addiction, if you will, not just alcohol, drugs, work, sex, food, gambling, exercise, believe it or not, can become a disorder. Exercise, we don't call it an addiction because it's not, once again, in the medical criteria. But even those things that we think are good for us, you know, when too much is too much, or enough is not enough. I don't know how else to put it. Becoming less productive, we know that can start to happen with compassion fatigue. We become less effective professionally and in our personal lives. There are some physical signs of compassion fatigue that have been gathered by people who work with this. And it really runs the gamut, anywhere from headaches to stomach and digestive problems, heart problems, cardiac issues, fatigue, sleeping problems. We know that fatigue and not really setting your table for success every day by getting a good night's sleep can cause a lot of problems. Loss of strength, increased accidents, our concentration starts to kind of go on us. Increased startle response. We jump at the slam of a door, believe it or not, can be a physical sign of compassion fatigue. There are work signs of compassion fatigue as well. We see increased absenteeism, a lot of tardiness. A lot of folks start to express a desire to quit, avoid intense client situations. There's a decrease in work performance. You see more errors, more problems with documentation accuracy. Keeping good records of our work, and for people, you know, obviously that are concerned about billable hours, you know, that's unfortunately one of the major stressors of our profession, our billable hour pressures, and we measure our productivity and our compensation by that, and we see that one of the work signs of compassion fatigue can be a decrease in documentation accuracy. And it can go both ways. Not forgetting to document some things and maybe adding to kind of make up for lost time. And that becomes an ethical issue. So starting to hope that clients don't show up, maybe, oh no, I don't want to answer this call, or I'm not going to return the missed call from a client. That's one of some of the work signs we see. As I mentioned earlier, there are similarities between compassion fatigue and burnout and differences. But I want to point out some of the similarities. There is an emotional exhaustion with both. There is a reduced sense of personal accomplishment or meaning in work. There's a mental exhaustion. There's a lot of isolation. And I don't care what problems I lecture about and talk about and hear people discussing among colleagues and other members of our profession. Isolating and avoiding interactions is at the top of the warning sign list of almost any type of distressful situation in our profession. The lawyer who suddenly isolates, and avoids interactions, doesn't want to be seen, doesn't want to talk, was always available, was always visible. And of course, what could have made it worse? I don't know how, than the imposed isolation and quarantine of the pandemic. Many people got into the habit of working really alone and don't want to go back into the workplace setting that they used to thrive in. So depersonalization, symptoms disconnected from real causes. physical exhaustion. These are similarities of burnout and compassion fatigue. So as I said, the differences are, and I have a slide, and you'll see that on the material, the differences. Compassion fatigue is caused by the exposure of traumatic material or traumatized clients. Burnout's caused by work-related attributes, such as job, coworkers, one's supervisor, poor work culture. Compassion fatigue, rapid onset, can be felt after the first experience of one's trauma. Rapid onset and can be felt after the first experience of one's trauma. Burnout builds up over time, gradually, as the work-related attributes pile up. Compassion fatigue describes the impact of helping others. Burnout describes the impact of a stressful workplace if, you know, if it's managed early, at least. Compassion fatigue, quicker recovery time than burnout, and burnout, obviously, then would tell us has a longer recovery time. So there's hope. That recovery time, it can come on to us quickly, but there is a quicker recovery time too. So the whole issue that I need to talk to you about now is why us? Why lawyers? What is it? And while most people experience stress in their lives, lawyers and people in the legal profession face a really unique conundrum, because for many of us, the drive and dedication that made us successful as lawyers is also what's causing stress and burning us out and causing us some of these other problems. Why? We have high expectations, high accountability. Our work-life balance can be blurred, as I mentioned earlier. We find our work days are getting longer, our work weeks are getting longer, the demands of the job don't seem to be diminishing in any way. A lot of people are saying that that's an impact of the pandemic on our profession, as we started to have a kind of a blur between home and work responsibilities. The work day began earlier, ended later. The work week thus was longer. It kind of blended into the weekends. I'll stop now on Tuesday and take care of some personal stuff, and then I'll make up for it later. And so we really don't ever take time to just, I need to just take a few days and not just sleep deprivation. Remember, we're talking about something that's more emotional and really spiritual, that buildup. We've got to unwind a little bit. So the practice of law, of course, is by its very nature conflict driven. We have a adversarial profession. We are sometimes accused of being emotionally detached. We're thinkers, not feelers. We have this win-lose, rigid thinking way of thinking. It's one lawyer's win is another lawyer's loss. The quest to win becomes paramount in our attempts and in our efforts to give our clients the zealous ethical representation that we're duty-bound to provide to them under the rules of professional conduct. But that can lend itself to the perfectionist and the maladaptive perfectionism, and we become excessively self-reliant. We don't want to ask for help. Nobody can do it like I can anyway, because I am indeed the problem solver. Not just one or two, everybody's problems, all their problems. And that's why I continually pose that question to people. Are you really a problem solver, or have you really just morphed into the problem collector? Let's face it, we're contacting when people have a problem that they can't fix themselves. But to represent our clients, we develop a skill to anticipate what? Everything that can go wrong. And to look for the worst case scenario. And some people think that in the law, pessimism is considered prudence and diligence. But in mental health terms, that can quickly become an anxiety or a stress disorder. What if, followed by the worst case scenario your mind can possibly imagine, is the at the heart of an anxiety disorder. So we contend in our profession with the strong emotions inherent in divorce and custody battles, potential loss or gain and liability in commercial cases, the imprisonment and death in criminal law, and the extended vulnerability of offering opinions and consultations on important matters. So as we rise to the challenge as lawyers of meeting the need to provide basic legal services, sometimes we find ourselves being exposed to the trauma of those clients that we're serving. I know people have been suffering, those who are in the profession and the part of the law that assists veterans. They may find themselves exposed to discussing the atrocities of war. The level of stress in those types of cases can be extreme. So we're taught to be aggressive and strong, to remain distant and objective, and to bury our emotions. Showing emotion can be a sign of being unprofessional. So attorneys are reticent to deal with their response to the stress and the emotions that surface. And it's no surprise that current research indicates that a growing number of attorneys are exhibiting a high rate of compassion fatigue. In other words, our personalities and our profession put us at high risk, not just to develop compassion fatigue, but substance use disorder and mental health issues as well. There was a study in 2015 by a gentleman named Patrick Krill, who was a lawyer and a certified drug and alcohol counselor, who performed a study. And so it's, as I said, 2015, COVID's there's nothing to do with this study. He did it for the ABA, and he found that lawyers, for example, alcohol, problematic drinking, 21% of all lawyers are problem drinkers, compared to 6.4% of the general population. And when I say problem drinkers, I mean people who drink to the point of it being hazardous to their health, or possibly alcohol-dependent people. He found that 28% of lawyers suffer from clinical depression, not the ups and downs, the mood swings based on the weather, other events of everyday life. We're talking about people who, if they were diagnosed by a medical professional, would qualify for a depression disorder. How's that compare? 7% of our population, general population, suffers from depression. 28% lawyers. 23% from stress disorders. 19% from anxiety disorders. So these statistics prove that. The case, and by the way, those numbers have not gone down. I'm sure you can realize that the impact of the pandemic was that, especially in the mental health area, those numbers are going up, especially those that are related to isolating and, unfortunately, suicidal ideation. Krill has recently published a study back in just really very recent, early 2023. That tells us, wait to hear this, the lawyer in a high stress position is 21 times more likely to have a suicidal ideation than a lawyer in a low stress environment. And add to that isolation and loneliness, and we have a really a perfect storm on our hands here. So you know what? This is the biggest thing I need to tell you right now, after I told you all those, I guess, scary statistics. It's okay. No one makes it out unscathed. It's normal to be affected by trauma. And the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we can begin to get help. So I need to switch now, and tell you, aside from being normal, if there is such a thing, you know, in any life, you know, I used to laugh and tell people that the only time I see normal is on the setting on a washing machine. But you know, the point I'm trying to make is that recognizing it is the most important coping skill you can give yourself. That it's okay to feel outraged, horrified, shocked, saddened. But if you're overwhelmed, you need to seek help and be aware of what's going on. So what are the steps for handling compassion fatigue? We're into the next area, strategies that work. Steps for handling compassion fatigue. Setting realistic goals for yourself, okay? Burnout and compassion fatigue are human responses to overwhelming tragedy and stress. There are steps you can take to avoid symptoms of stress, anxiety, and depression. You have to understand the symptoms of compassion fatigue. I know that they're natural and that they can be managed. Hey, we chose a profession that's challenging and rewarding. It is the fact that we have compassion and that can make us so fatigued and stressed. We didn't care, we wouldn't crash and burn, I know. The key is being aware of the signs and taking proactive steps to address it. That can involve talking to someone. And that can be challenging for lawyers. We tend to isolate. I already told you that. So recognizing it, that's what the purpose of this program is. Crack through the barrier by reaching out to someone you can trust, a colleague, a mental health professional, a friend, a family member. Take more than, you got to take time off. You got to take a break and recharge your batteries. And that means a real vacation. Weekends don't count. Boundaries have to be maintained, okay? So not avoiding vacations, because you don't want to have all the work pile up while you're gone. You know, so you bring your work with you. That's not a vacation. That's not a vacation. Okay? Establish healthy routines, including sleep. Develop interests outside of your career, a hobby, a social group, travel. Get your mind off the stressors of your work, okay? Do one thing every day that's stress-free and brings you some pleasure. Disconnecting from screen devices. That's a topic in and of itself, the fact that we've become shackled to our screens. Find an experience that gives you joy and practice it every single day. Hey, that may even mean just laughing. You know, it's been proven that it's a stress buster to laugh, a good hearty belly laugh. So sometimes it can be something that you've heard of, mindfulness, focusing on the immediate present, enjoying the moment, varying our routines, don't get trapped in a rut. All these things are good steps for handling compassion fatigue. But the most important, once again, is understanding that the symptoms of compassion fatigue are natural and can be managed. Okay, that's important. There are some others. here's some that are a little more difficult, but they have the best long-term results. Okay, create a cultural change in the work environment which values relationships. Actually, do something about the hours, quote unquote. Maintain a realistic work-life balance. Try treating people in a civil, professional manner at all times. Civility isn't just about when it's in your best interest to be civil and professional. Try it all the time as a manner of living. Encourage friendships, communication, mentoring, reducing isolation. Okay? But most of all, in this culture of ours, we need to create an environment that encourages the sharing and discussion of things that cause us stress and distress. Sometimes that means we've got to really work on setting boundaries. Setting boundaries. And one of the things that I find when I speak to lawyers, it doesn't matter if they're young, new lawyers, middle of their career, later in life, you know, boundaries are a problem. Disconnecting, saying, you know, this I will not do at certain times, this I will do. And this is when setting some realistic goals for ourselves. As I said, that word realistic is a problem.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is FAR, F-A-R, all lowercase, FAR. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is FAR, F-A-R, all lowercase, FAR. Please take a moment and write this down.
Lawyers. And for many people who have just like their to-do list is got 10 things on it. And unfortunately, for the lawyer and the perfectionist, unless they get all 10 done, they've had a bad day or a bad week, and it stresses them out. So maybe here's a good tip. That to-do list, if you're a list maker, put 4 things on it. You have a better chance of getting them all done, and that will reduce your stress. Some people, and I'm one of them, is a firm believer in meditation. It's really keeps us present. It keeps us from projecting into the future, because when we do that, eventually this work of ours can start us on a spiral, as I mentioned earlier, where we always project negatively. You know, the problems are everywhere, around every corner. And we're not being diligent. We're not, we're just being overly pessimistic, and we over emphasize problems that don't exist. We need to identify our true feelings, and that's what meditation helps us with. We don't attach ourselves to our feelings. We acknowledge them, but we don't attach them. I just spoke to some other folks this morning. I talk about mountains and clouds. You know, the mountains are there. They are the things that never change. And by the way, I don't live anywhere near mountains, so I use sometimes a building. Okay, and I just can focus on that. That's stable. That's not going anywhere. The clouds I equate to my problems. They're my feelings. Okay, I don't attach to them. They will go. They will move. And they drift right on by. And eventually, they're gone. I don't follow those feelings. I don't follow those attitudes. I let them move on. Sometimes that involves some breathing, reducing the mental chatter, eliminating those what-ifs, keeping myself away from those worst-case scenarios. 'Cause it's normal for us to feel waves of emotion in the work that we do. So one of the things that also helps, and it only takes, this is a 1 minute exercise I'm going to talk to you about right now. I mean, literally a 60 second exercise. Today I'm grateful for, and then you take 1 minute. And by the way, you try to not use your smartphone. Take a piece of paper and a writing implement, pen, pencil, whatever. Write down everything you have to be grateful for. But do it for 60 seconds. That's it. 60 seconds, folks. You'd be shocked at how many things you can write down in 60 seconds that you have to be grateful for. Gratitude, when you memorialize it, when you have a journal of some sort, even if it's, I said, one sheet of paper, it gives us a positive state of mind. We could become centered on others and become a little more humble. Some of us could use that. We boost our productivity. And really, there's a direct correlation between some gratitude in our lives and better sleep, happiness, and really just a peaceful state of mind. And it's really all part of something that we call trauma-informed care. Part of trauma-informed care is recognizing that what we come across at our work can wound us. It may not wound us physically. It may wound our souls, so to speak. Because of our jobs, we're exposed to vicarious or secondary trauma. Okay, secondary trauma stress can lead to these other issues I mentioned: burnout, compassion fatigue. We need to do something. We need to mitigate compassion fatigue by raising our awareness. What's it mean to be trauma informed? Okay, awareness. Understanding what compassion fatigue is and periodically self-assessing for it. Debriefing. In other words, talking regularly with other people in our profession who understand and are supportive. So this may involve talking about the traumatic material that you've just been exposed to, how you think about it, how you feel about it, how it's affecting you. And then being what I call intentional. Being intentional. you're overwhelmed and struggling with depression, anxiety, substance use or misuse, compassion fatigue, put a plan in place to change it. Turn off the fight or flight response, part of the stress cycle of your sympathetic nervous system, and turn on the relaxation or the rest and digest parasympathetic nervous system. Movement is medicine. You know, get a hobby that involves some movement. And it could be gardening. It could be sports, golf. It could play in, playing an instrument, something. But really, the most important part of it, to be trauma-informed, is if you're struggling, don't wait. Seek assistance to help you to implement the changes and redirect, I should say, the thoughts that tell you, I should be able to do this by myself, or worse yet, I have to do this alone, or I will look weak. Your new mantra can be and must really become, I don't have to do it all by myself. So what keeps us from seeking or accepting help in our profession? Shame, embarrassment, the stigma that surrounds mental health issues, especially the same ones that are stigmatized in society, are disproportionately magnified in the legal profession. No one wants to be labeled depressed, stressed, burned out, bipolar, whatever mental health issue. You know, it's one thing, we don't want to be accused of being addicts and alcoholics either, but, well, you know, that's it's one thing to say drinking is a problem. Nobody wants to talk about why they drink. That's been the problem. We've seen the big reversal in the lawyer assistance world, you know, where we started off many years ago helping the quote-unquote lawyer who drank too much. Now we find it's completely reversed. The vast majority of the callers, at least we see this in Pennsylvania, and I think I can speak for most of the programs in the country. Overwhelming majority of our callers now have as a primary presenting concern their mental health. But lawyers love to engage in denial, and I'm not one of them mentality. It's one of the things that keeps us from asking for help. And really, unfortunately, sometimes we enable one another in our profession. We kind of sweep the, and here's that key word again, normal stresses of our profession and sweep them under the rug instead of talking about them, okay? Pretending they don't exist. That's called enabling in the recovery world and in the treatment world, okay? And it prevents people. It doesn't help people. It prevents them from getting the help that they so desperately need, okay? So what can you do? You know, it's not an easy goal. Remember that really, I need you to be at the center of the ripple effect. And you're gonna see a portion of this presentation that's got that image on it. And I put that on every single program that I give. What can you do? You need to be at the center of the ripple effect. And that can be something as simple as asking a question of a colleague. How are you? What's going on? I haven't spoken to you in a while. We haven't seen you in a while. Let's talk. Are there anything's going on that you want to talk to me about? Instead of, indicating that there's problems, maybe it's just a matter of talking about them and banding together and allowing ourselves to be a bit more human during these trying times, this new normal, as they call it. It's not only going to help individuals in the short term, it's going to benefit law firms, organizations, all of us in the long run. We need to educate and emphasize that well-being is a part of being a good, competent lawyer. It's part of it. That's why we need to diminish and decrease the stigma. Okay? Because, you know, we're lawyers. We impact people's lives every single day. A lawyer somewhere is impacting society. It's part of what we do. But that also means that somewhere an impaired lawyer may be influencing society somewhere. So that's why it's up to all of us in this profession to ask questions. And more importantly, it's up to all of us to pick up the phone maybe and call a lawyer's assistance program. You know, it's one thing to talk about these things. And you're going to see a quote that I have on this presentation from none other than Walt Disney, who said that the way to get started is to quit talking and begin doing. And that's what we need. That's what we need. We need more doing and less talking. And by educating people in our profession, our courts all feel that that's part of being a professional, competent, ethical attorney, part of the educational process, speaking about these things instead of just pushing them aside. So I know that that's how, frankly, my life was saved. You know, I pushed all these problems in my life away, all of them. And I just decided I can make these feelings go away with alcohol. I can make these feelings go away with drugs. But gosh, I'm not going to talk about them. What will people say? What will they think? Nobody's going to want a lawyer that talks about their own problems. Remember, I'm the problem solver. So I just stuffed all of my feelings and tried to make them go away some other way without talking about them. That is, you know, bringing into other people into my life. And finally, that ripple effect took place in my own life. That's why I keep that image on my programs. Because I actually met with someone who just asked me that simple question. Hey, Brian, what's going on? You okay? Something doesn't seem quite right with you. And that's the day my whole life changed. Just like that. Because that's the day I said, yes, there is something going on. And before I knew it, a lawyer's assistance program, an organization that I had never heard of, didn't know existed, came into my life and said, let us help you. Let us help you. And they did. And it's just that difficult, but it's just that simple. I said yes. And that word changed my life. So I hope that you get something out of this program, whether you're in the area of law that maybe subject to compassion fatigue or not. I hope you got the message here, which is all of these problems are okay to talk about. It's part of what we do for a living. Why do we become lawyers? That's the first question I ask you. We want to help people. But guess what? For the same reason that they tell us when we're on those airplanes, if you're traveling with someone that needs help and the oxygen mask comes down, put your own mask on first. Why? Because you have to put your own mask on before you can help the person you're with. Lawyers need to put their own oxygen masks on first. Then we can help our clients, our families, our colleagues. So please remember that. And don't wait. You can start today. So once again, my name is Brian Quinn. I'm the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania. Thank you for being here with us today.